Welcome into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Here on Thursday, we like to feature some of the best in the paranormal world, and today I have two of them, and very talented guys. In fact, so talented that Rosemary Ellen Guiley herself tapped them to be on her Visionary Living imprint, book imprint, before, unfortunately, she passed away. And they've written two books on that imprint. Today we're going to talk about their latest, Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries. They're also the two co-owners of the Michigan Paracon, the largest paranormal convention out there. And boy, I'm telling you, in late August, I celebrate two things. One, of course, me getting another trip around the sun. I consider that a rarity. And two, Michigan Paracon, because this thing is huge, folks. Anybody who's anybody is at this convention, and you pretty much can run into anybody you've ever wanted to meet ever at the Michigan Paracon. So let me introduce our guests today. And two of these, all I can say is just icons in the paranormal field. These guys are movers and shakers, and they absolutely have put together one of the best paranormal conventions in the country and really changed the paranormal as we know it. We'll start with Brad Blair. Brad Blair is a business owner in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and has formed half of Michigan Paracon. He's also won half of the Creaking Door Paranormal Radio Show. And then there is Tim Ellis. Tim Ellis also is a, I'm going to say this in case he has his ears open right now, is a radio station owner in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. I'll have my file and my resume ready in case this little podcast goes under. He's the owner-operator and morning show host at Eagle 95.1 WUPN in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. He's also, again, one half owner of Michigan Paracon and also, well, gosh, you guys can tout your own stuff here. You also one half of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio Show. Let's introduce to Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, Tim Ellis and Brad Blair. Guys, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Hey, thanks for having us in. And what a gracious intro. You could really keep going, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, we were just sitting here basking in all that. But I got to be honest, Tim, we're still looking around the studio trying to find that. You said there were two of the best in the field. We're still wondering who they are.
Let's
just get our time in before he gets them on.
Right, exactly. We're the openers for whoever they are.
Oh, come on now, you guys. For real. I got to tell you, you guys are pretty darn good authors as well. You know, I got a chance to page through Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries, and I had no idea, you know, I growing up in Minnesota, by the way, thanks for calling it the land of bad football. I knew who you were talking about.
but yeah, boy.
You seem to have a little team called the Detroit Lions your way, who hasn't exactly done anything in quite a few years.
That is so true.
So we're biding our time.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're getting there. You're getting there. I'll just say, you know, you've put together, I mean, although you made a strange quarterback. Yeah. Although this isn't football talk, but, you know, you made a strange quarterback choice recently.
Yeah, I agree.
But, I mean, you know, a nice shot, by the way, in the book. I'm still getting over that, as you can tell. But you guys have turned out a very good book. I didn't realize how many legends and lore, and especially lake monsters there are. I don't think I'm ever going to step foot in Lake Superior again. I know I've dipped my toe in the water and taken a boat out there once or twice. But man, when you start to really start to see, especially in the Great Lakes area, how many legends and lore are out there, and then you start talking about USOs and things that we're going to be getting into today. Boy, do we live in a scary place. I always thought it was serene and nice. What's up with that?
It is. But when you look back, and a lot of people make the mistake of considering American history to start with the Europeans landing, but the Great Lakes region is so rich in Native American lore and legend. And this was most of the Great Lakes region was Native American homeland for centuries, if not millennia. before the Europeans decided to sail across and kind of change everything. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of what we researched into and a lot of what we like to play with and go off of actually originates from centuries and centuries ago through the native lore.
Yeah, and you had mentioned that, you know, you didn't realize there were so many. And trust me, Tim, that book is just scratching the surface. I mean, that was just a handful of our favorites that we found as we were doing the research. There were so many that that are on the cutting room floor that it's amazing. This cool little corner of the world that we live in. And when we call, you know, the book's called Great Lakes, Monsters and Mysteries, we consider any state that is touching any of the Great Lakes was fair game for us to research. So that's the general area we're talking about.
Yeah, everything from New York to Minnesota and in between and above and under and into Ontario.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have one main monster we focus on, I think, in the Twin Cities metro area, and that, you know, we go further south for that, and that's in Lake Pepin. We talk about Pepe. That's kind of our version of the Loch Ness Monster. And even then, newscasters kind of attack it with a chuckle. You know, it's always the, oh, there's Pepe, you know, and they had their little festival around Pepe down in Lake City, and it occurs a little later in the summer, even early fall.
Wasn't that the skunk and Bugs Bunny?
Yes, it was. Pepe Le Pew.
Different Pepe. You know, and I love to hear that there's a festival for that, because I think it's those little festivals that really help to keep the legends and stories alive and keep them in the forefront so that people don't forget about them. Like, you know, we've got Pressy here in Lake Superior that I would love to see a small little
Pressy Fest.
Yeah, Pressy Fest, exactly, for it. So, and we don't. Maybe that's something Brad and I should start. And
maybe we should. That might be a new side gig. We
absolutely
could, have little inflatable Pressy monsters and sell pasties.
I like it. So it's also UP. Yeah. But you know, it was great to hear that, because I think those little festivals like that are important for these types of legends.
Well, see, now I was just going to ask you the opposite question here, guys, and that is, does that diminish the spookiness or the scariness of the legend? Because you would think that those legends are there to keep people off the water or aware of the water or the dangers of what could be out there in the water. Here we've taken Pepe and diminished it into literally a cute little monster. I mean, it's because it is that. There are the cute little inflatable Pepes or the little stuffed Pepes, and there is food and there's food trucks and there's, you know, people walking around the lake and there's people, you know, cruising along the lake on jet skis and boats. And I mean, sure, I'm sure a Pressy Fest would be wonderful, but is that something that is going to diminish the legend?
I don't know if it's going to diminish it. I think it'll keep it alive, because we're in a day and time now that these things are so easily pushed aside and forgotten. And I know exactly where you're coming from, Tim, where you say that these were, you know, tales that were told to keep people off the water or at least show some respect. You go back and again, delving into Native American lore, and Gassiandeetha, one of the more terrifying lake monsters, that was a dragon that fell from the sky that would tip over ships and eat sailors if they dared to venture out when it was rough. You know, you had all of these legends out there as, you know, cautionary tales, but now it's the day in that we live in with the science and internet and all of these capabilities, it's easy to forget a lot of these old legends. So things like that, just to point them out. And I mean, a lot of people have probably never heard of Pepe outside of the festival. So it's granting some, I don't know that I would say it's, you know, furthering the legend in a way that it was originally meant to be, but it's keeping it alive.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, look at how, and this is on a grander scale, talking Pepe to Bigfoot, but look how pop culture Bigfoot has become. And beyond how pop culture it is, there's still the stories and the legends that are scary and will keep young kids out of the forest at night. And so you get through the little pomp and circumstance of it, of these little festivals. Underlying all of that, I believe, is really what it's doing, and it's helping to keep those legends alive.
Let me start with Brad and we'll go to Tim. Brad, why do you think that, I mean, we look at this book that you guys have out now. Why do you think it is that we've lost track of our American lore as far as these great monsters that we have right in our own backyard, but we're so focused on Loch Ness across the pond, or the legends and lore that are maybe from the homeland, as we might call it, if your homeland is Scotland. Why is it we're so focused over there and we're not focused on the stuff that's in our own backyard?
Well, there's a lot of these legends that come over, you know, America being the melting pot that people brought in and kind of adopted as their own, and really, I think, spread throughout the U.S., North America in general, that are knockoffs of some of these old ones. But let's face it, Pressy gets pretty good press. We get a lot of, you know, maybe every year, 2 years, we'll get some kind of reporter doing up a story, or there'll be something on the news that somebody's been out in Lake Superior and has seen our Lake Superior monster. But it's not to the level that I think the Loch Ness monster, those legends go back so many decades and they're so repetitive. Nobody gets press like that. You know, no other creatures outside of maybe Bigfoot, and definitely no other sea creatures, get the kind of press, kind of cultural reaction that a Loch Ness monster takes. As far as American, I don't know. What do you think, Tim? I would say Bigfoot is probably overwhelmingly a North American creature, with obviously, you know, your Yeti, or, you know, the whole abominable snowman, and different spread throughout the world. But talking to people in other cultures, it doesn't seem like the hairy wild man of the forest is as big of an icon as it is here in North America.
Yeah, you know, and so the Bigfoot thing is kind of that hybrid, because, you know, the abominable and Sasquatch and all of those have been part of the native lore forever, mm-hmm, at different corners of the world. But the Bigfoot, as we know it, actually is a creation from the United States in California. When that, as a matter of fact, we talk about that in the book, where Bigfoot, as in that name, started. So that's kind of the hybrid creation there, and I really think it's what just media has been able to grab onto, and it's a regional thing. So Pressy is more right here in our backyard, but Bigfoot is everywhere. So you've got media from all over the place grabbing those types of stories and talking about. Now Loch Ness is a little bit different, because Loch Ness is not everywhere, but for whatever reason, Loch Ness is the one that has grabbed the media attention. And so I really think it's just a matter of which media has really grabbed onto and helped push it. You know, the power of radio, you're in it. So the power of media, once you get behind it and you put a microphone behind it or a camera behind it, and it just helps to spread the word more.
There's a subject in your book, and I know part of this too, I think, is that we have a problem at times with the majority of our society buying into lore. I think it's, you know, ghosts we can buy, because I think ghosts as a species, as a society, we want to believe that we live on in more than name only. You know, we want to believe that our energy, our souls transform, they go past this body, and we want to live forever, or at least we believe we live forever. I'm not taking an atheist view here, by the way. I'm just saying we want to stretch on beyond this body. I think we believe in ghosts probably the most as a species. But then I think there's probably a belief hierarchy as to what we would believe in as, in the paranormal hierarchy. And is it safe to say, and I'm taking a stretch here, and I'm going to start with Brad again, is it safe to say that there is a hierarchy here as far as what people will believe in? And we could go from UFOs to down the cryptid line, you know, Bigfoot, sea monsters, and then even go down as far as fairies and puckwudgies and leprechaun, as to what people will buy into and what people will put out there and stand the litmus test of, will I be ashamed by it or not?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a study done, it's been a few years now. Tim and I have cited it in some talks that we've given over the years. But they interviewed and they talk to different people, different areas of society, and to see just exactly what that belief system was. And it was somewhere around the area of 50% that believed in ghosts or would admit to it at the time. But they also called out things such as sea serpents, UFOs, and even vampires. And I want to say it was an interesting collaboration. There were more, I believe it was women by a far margin that believed mm-hmm. in ghosts overall than men. And men were way more likely to believe in UFOs. Women were more likely to believe in vampires. It was it was kind of mind blowing to see what the variance was with these different categories that they put out there. But yeah, definitely. I think with ghosts, and that's something that, you know, near and dear to both Tim and my hearts, that's kind of what we grew up on, were the old ghost stories. And, you know, it's taught to kids at such a young age, whether it be through religion, through Boy Scouts telling ghost stories around a campfire, or just old family tales. Ghosts are something that in every culture, every day, you've got somebody out there telling a ghost story or just handing these down, these generational supernatural stories that have been through the family for years. When you get into your cryptids, into your ufology, different things along that lines, maybe somebody in the family did have an encounter with a UFO that you're going to hear about, but that's going to burn that story out after a while. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not, I don't think, as much repetition in those areas as there are with the good old fashioned ghost story.
Yeah, for sure.
Tim, let me ask you this. Why do you feel, and we're going to kind of go into one of the subjects in the book, because I found it interesting. You know, I've had my own personal talks with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We were on the Queen Mary, doing a trip on the Queen Mary, and I had the lovely fortune of having lunch with her. And we sat for 2.5 hours, had lunch. I took her off site. We went to a restaurant, and so I got to bend her ear, and I said, "Rosemary, I really have a problem with the subject of like fairies and leprechauns." And so she kind of looked at me kind of, you know, puzzled, and she put her guard up right away, because she thought I was going to have a verbal tussle with her about fairies and leprechauns. And I said, no, you don't have to get, you don't have to get in a defensive position about this. It's just that in my mind, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is always Tinkerbell. Okay. But then the other thing I have a hard time with is, I guess maybe I have too logical of a mind that I can't wrap my head around it. What I'll give you guys credit for, and this is what I want to address with you here, Tim, is for the first time ever, someone came across in this book and gave me an explanation. And it comes from a Native American bit of lore of how a leprechaun or a fairy in the form of a Pukwudgie could be made or could exist or could be around. And even though it has a supernatural slant to it, it really makes me go, okay, yeah, I could see that. And the fact that you guys report an actual sighting of mm-hmm. lights that could form into what looks like a fairy folk. Okay, I get what you're seeing now. Explain to me why it's so hard for people to wrap their head around fairy folk.
Well, I think this goes right back to what we were just saying, the power of the media. It can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. And it has given us the vision of what we are supposed to think fairies and leprechauns look like. As you said, you think Tinkerbell, you think leprechaun, you think of those horrible B movies that came out. I think they're up to like Leprechaun 6 now or something.
Yes. I think Lucky Charms.
Or Lucky Charms, right. Yeah, so media has put in our heads what we are supposed to believe these things look like or how they act, when really it's just by name only. I think it's got to be broken down to something much more simpler, which is nothing more than nature spirits and possibly even interdimensional or you know, wherever or however they exist within nature. And we don't see them all the time, or we see them when they want us to see them. I really think it's just a matter of forgetting what Hollywood and television has told us what they look like and really breaking it down.
Brad, why can't people say something to the effect of, well, have you ever seen a strange little light that's flown around you? And even though you may mistake it for a firefly at that point, why can't you just explain that as maybe that's a fairy and not a firefly? Why can't we tie the logical to the spiritual and say, you know what, why can't you just let go and believe?
I think it's the same with any supernatural encounter. You know, you've got that portion of society that doesn't want to admit, one, to themselves what they're seeing, experiencing, but definitely don't want to go out and talk to a neighbor and say, hey, did you happen to see the fairies floating through the backfield last night? You know, unfortunately, a lot of people won't give that any type of rational thought, and they'll just think, well, you know, they're nuts, they're hitting the bottle again. But no, it's interesting in our area, specifically here in northern Michigan, Mackinac Island, which is a huge tourist trap, tourist destination. Mm-hmm. They've had these encounters there dating back to Native American lore. And this is something that I've experienced firsthand. And I was not alone. I was with a group of people at the time, and everybody in the group saw this. So there was no denying it. It wasn't a fireflies by any means. I've never seen a firefly move like these did. And yeah, I think you get the down to one of these experiences that you have enough eyewitnesses that people are a lot more willing to talk about it, because, well, I'm not the only one that saw it. Tim saw it too. Steve saw it too. You know, you can go back where it's not just something that you saw that you're going to try and explain away, that, well, maybe it was a firefly, you know, maybe I was looking at something the wrong way. So it's that whole power of rational thought that people try to explain away anything that doesn't quite fit into their belief system. And I think fairies and leprechauns would definitely fall into those categories. Sure.
Who was it that had the neighbor who had the leprechaun experience? Was it Tim? Was it Brad?
It was a lady that I had spoken. It was a couple I was speaking with at an event, and they had had, there's a few different experiences in the book. So what I think you're talking about, I had a couple come up and just tell me flat out, we bought this piece of property on the coast of Lake Michigan and we saw a leprechaun on it. And, you know, I was, you know, being in the paranormal field for as many years as I have been, I was taken aback even then. But I said, well, tell me about it. What exactly did you see? And they explained it as your stereotypical leprechaun would be, a small guy in a little suit, and he was staring at us, and he took off and ran away, and we were thinking about following him, but we thought better of it. You know, which I probably would too, but they said it was the weirdest thing. And then the lady went on to tell me that she actually had a picture of it. I said, well, you have to send this to me. So we exchanged information. And of course, I never heard from her after that. But just the story in and of itself, and her husband didn't really want her talking about it, didn't really want her saying anything. And it was very obvious that he was uncomfortable when she was telling it. But once I accepted what they were telling me and listened to them with an open mind and kind of took their notes to heart, he relaxed quite a bit and actually got in on the conversation. So again, a lot of it's societal acceptance on these categories.
And one thing we learned while writing this book, Tim, was, I mean, something Brad and I have experienced for many, many years being on the paranormal side of things and investigating haunted locations, is people who have those experiences with the ghosts, you know, their experience is real to them. You'll never change their mind, but, and to no surprise, it shouldn't have been a surprise, but as we kind of went out of our comfort zone a little bit to do this latest book, which was more about not ghosts than and much more about lores and monsters and fairies and everything else, it's the same for those people who experience these situations. Their situations, their experience is as real as you and I and Brad sitting here talking right now. So it was you see it in their face when you're sitting down and interviewing them. You can tell that what happened to them was as real as the day is long.
Wow. Guys, I tell you what, at this point, we got to take our break here in the program. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit and get into a little bit UFOs and USOs and something that's akin to the Bermuda Triangle that's inside the Great Lakes. We'll talk about that when we get back. Our guests are Tim Ellis and Brad Blair. They're the co-founders of the Michigan Paracon. They also have a book out there that you're going to want to get a hold of, and the subject of what we're talking about here today. That book is called Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries, and the book itself, along with their other book, Upernatural Haunts, is available at upernaturalhaunts.com. We'll have a link in the description of this program. When we come back, more with Tim Ellis and Brad Blair here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guests are Tim Ellis and Brad Blair, both co-creators of the Michigan Paracon, which is going on at the end of August here. We'll give the exact dates in just a moment. Also, they are the co-creators of Creaking Door Paranormal Radio. You can find those podcasts. We'll have a link to those as well. And they are the co-authors of Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries. We will have the link to upernaturalhaunts.com where you can get that book and their other book, Upernatural Haunts. Get it because it's tied into the website there. Well, it's clever. It's clever, guys. It's clever. I see what you did there. Before the break, guys, I was teasing that we were going to start talking about UFOs and USOs. One of the phenomena that we've discussed over the years, which seems unusual, and I get this question a lot from listeners, why an unidentified submersible object, why go into the water? I mean, these things can fly about as much as they want. It's not like we can do anything to them as they fly out about the night sky. But Brad, let me ask you, why would you fly under the water? Or why would you even make a base in the water if you're a UFO?
Well, you have to remember, we have no idea what UFOs, USOs actually are or what the science behind them is or may be. So there could be some component that they need something to do with the water, some mineral that's under the water of the Great Lakes. As we've seen and we talk about some in the book, there are several locations that people think or have reason to believe there may be some type of a USO base located. That and there's also the hideaway protection factors in there that people can't easily get at these objects or these bases when they're at the depths in the water, especially here in deeper waters that the Great Lakes offer, where they wouldn't necessarily be easily observed. So there's the hideout factor there. We just don't know, which is a great part of the mystery.
There's a tale in the book having to do with a UFO. I believe it's over, was it Lake Michigan? Having to do with two airmen who went to tail this, I think it was in the 50s.
Oh, the Kinross
incident. Oh, that's the Kinross. That's yes. That's Lake Superior. That happened right here in our backyard.
Oh, okay, Lake Superior. Could you tell that story for us just briefly?
Yeah, so it was the height of the Cold War, and the two pilots, there was an unidentified flying object seen coming over Lake Superior, and then ended up crossing right over the Sioux Locks, which is a no-no. That is the one of the largest shipping channels in the world. And, you know, height of the Cold War, and you see an unidentified flying object, you know, flying over that airspace, which was not allowed. Then that, and we at that time had the Air Force base about 20 minutes just out of Sault Ste. Marie in Kinross. And at that point, they scrambled the jet. It was a two-pilot kind of jet, and by this time the object had moved out into Lake Superior, and the jet followed it, and it was seen on radar from the actual base, and eventually, and this is the very condensed version mm-hmm. of it of the story, on the radar, the jet and the UFO become one, and then both are gone. So you see the jet finally getting close enough to the UFO, all of a sudden it becomes one blip and then there's no blip. Both are completely gone. And to this day, there's been no found wreckage, no bodies, nothing to show that there was a collision or that there was a wreck or that something should have fallen into Lake Superior. And even the search and rescue, there was no oil slick. There was nothing. These two objects completely gone.
Yeah, neither serviceman was ever heard from again. One of the more interesting is legends that surrounds it. I haven't seen anything to completely validate it, but they claim that the people back at the radar base that were listening in that had the last communications with these two pilots right before they merged with the object, that a few minutes after everything had disappeared, heard voices crackling through, very broken up again, that they claimed to be Felix Moncla, the pilot of that flight. So we really don't know what happened. Like Tim said, there was no wreckage ever found, nothing. They scoured the areas, they've searched the bottom of Lake Superior, and they've never came up with anything to explain either of these objects. And one thing too, and as Tim said, this is a very condensed version, but the speeds that this unidentified object were going at were nothing that was known by man at the time that could reach these speeds. So it's such a fascinating story. I can't believe it doesn't get more press than it does.
Yeah, that's a great point, because it truly is a military mystery. It kind of has that feeling of Roswell, where in the sense that the story broke immediately to the press, and then a day later, the military comes out with these ridiculous excuses saying that they crashed into a Canadian airliner that had crossed over flew the wrong way or something like that along those lines. And so they tried to do these cover-ups, just like you saw in Roswell. Mm-hmm. And I guess this kind of goes back hand in hand what we're talking about there in the first segment, which is why do certain stories get the press like Roswell did? But this story is just as fascinating as that story is.
Very much so. And I believe in the book, and I don't know if you mentioned this already or not, but in the book, when John Tenney had been doing the Freedom of Information Act searches, he originally, there was 50 pages of the report, right? And then he found an additional 200 pages.
Yeah. Exactly. And leave it to John Tenney to push those buttons and get that to happen. But yeah, he's the one who really helped to break this case open, get a plaque and monument done up in honor for the families who are still out there today of these two lost pilots. These are two pilots. These are two American soldiers who gave their lives in the defense of the country, and they just get swept under the rug. And it's actually very frustrating.
Wasn't there something in the FOIA where it had said that at one point they thought they had found by sonar not only the plane intact, but they had also found the USO intact, and then that got wiped?
That wasn't part of the FOIA. This group that came out called Great Lakes Dive Company or something.
They kind of appeared out of nowhere and disappeared suddenly after this. It adds another level to the mystery.
It does. It was this supposed dive company in the area. And Linda Moulton Howe interviewed these guys, and it was all over. Why am I drawing a blank on, we're on Darkness Radio. That's all I care about. Yeah. But that other radio program that I'm drawing a blank on.
Coast to Coast, I believe.
Thank you. Yes.
Heavily at the time.
They did. And so this dive company claimed that they had sonar that showed the wreck, a plane with a dislodged wing, and then this cylindrical, like a round disc shape embedded in the sand of Lake Superior. And then as the popularity of this report came out and they actually released pictures, they're out there. You can Google it and find them. Then all of a sudden, this supposed company just went dark and nothing. No one could find them. So to this day, we're believing it was a hoax, because I think the pressure got to them. The heat was turning up, and they just went dark on it.
And of course, the amount of money to try and go out there and excavate those two craft would be too much.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's not like you can just go wildly, blindly digging for them either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you got a ton of money.
Which none of us do.
No, exactly. Exactly. You have there in your neck of the woods something akin to the Bermuda Triangle. Describe to us and tell us what exactly that is.
So the, yeah, this one's moving over to the west side now, down in Lake Michigan. There's actually called the Great Lakes Triangle in Lake Michigan, where a large number of boats just disappearing, weird storms popping up. It, basically, everything you hear of the Bermuda Triangle happening all in this area of Lake Michigan, which is almost right in the middle of the lake itself, and spans across to Illinois and Michigan and up into the lake. And so it's a fascinating area, and UFOs and USOs and all of that stuff heavily seen right in that spot.
Wow.
Now, so, Brad, I think you researched one of the stories of that area that was really fascinating.
There were quite a few that were fascinating, right, in that area. One of them was the largest commercial plane wreck at the day happened in that area, and they still have not been able to recover any of the. They've found some flotsam that came out of the plane.
Okay. But
they've never been able to find the plane. They have no idea what caused it to go down. It just suddenly left the screen, left the radar screen, and it was gone. But yeah, there's quite a few USO sightings through that area. One of a plane that was flying over what they described as, and several passengers viewed for a lengthy time, as a object going briskly under the water, very well lit. It was in the evening, and they followed this, and all of a sudden it disappeared. And come to find out, when some of these people, some of the pilots, were talking with other people, this seems to happen on somewhat of a regular basis over the same area in Lake Michigan. Again, that's right off of, I believe that one was right off of Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Right. Okay.
From that area. So
there's also that story that I think it was part of your one of the chapters in the book, that fascinating story of the captain, that his door was locked from the inside. And he just went disappeared.
Yeah, it was on a commercial vessel, and they were out in the middle of the lake, and the captain, as it is, you know, has to navigate, has to take care. This was back, I believe, in the 40s. This may have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
They were out in the middle of the lake, so he said, "You know what? I'm going to go take a nap. Wake me up when we start getting closer to shore." And you know, everything was fine. Conditions weren't bad at all. He went and laid down, and the weather started kicking up. It got a little rough, and they were starting to approach their destination. And the first mate says, "Well, go wake up the captain. Tell him we're almost there." So he went down and knocked on the captain's door, and couldn't hear any movement. Yelled and. Nope. He went back to the first mate and said, "I think something's wrong." He said, "The captain's not responding. The door is locked. I tried to get in. It's locked from the inside." So the first mate went down with a couple of other guys, and they forcibly kicked the door in. The door had been locked from the inside. There was no other egress to the room, but the captain was gone.
Just I love that story.
Literally vanished into nowhere and was never seen or heard from again. Yeah. There was no other way he could have gotten out of the room. If you're familiar at all with the old school lakes vessels, these are tight quarters. It's not like they're airy with a patio door that you can go out and get some air. This door had been locked from the interior, and the captain was just gone, disappeared. Another victim of the Great Lakes Triangle.
Now that stands to reason, you know, you've had people who have gone through the Bermuda Triangle who claim they've lost time, or they feel like they've entered a portal. Do you feel like this is one of those same types of triangles where it may be one of those portals?
It could be. What we've never really discussed along that lines with it. It's been interesting over the years because Tim and I have done paranormal research for going on 30 years now, but it seems that when we went back and when we wrote the Upernatural Haunts book and looked at some of our better case files that had the most evidence and some of the best stories associated with them, most of them were in waterfront areas on large bodies of water. Well, most of them were on the Great Lakes or connecting bodies of water. So I do feel there's something to do with the energy that surrounds these bodies of water, the movement, the energy that's given off that may fuel. It may fuel a portal. It may fuel some of this supernatural activity that we've been fortunate enough to capture over the years. And it definitely fuels some of the great legends and stories from the area.
Now, that's a freshwater lake, right?
Correct.
Yep. Okay. Everything in the Great Lakes is.
See, so the only difference, as far as I know, between between the Bermuda Triangle and what you're talking about is freshwater and saline, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I'm trying to think what the difference would be to build one portal or another. Not like I'm out here building portals, gentlemen, in my spare time.
You want our secret recipe.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to find out the Colonel's secret recipe for building portals. Yeah. It seems curious to me as to why these portals get built. And do you think, guys, and let me throw it at Tim first, do you think that this is part of, and is it related to these USOs? Do you think it's just another part of maybe USOs building a base? Do you think a portal comes with it, and that's why these triangles are established in different areas of the world?
I think it's as good a theory as any. If you really kind of lay it out and look at the big picture, and could, if that's the case, that there are USO bases underneath, and there's an alien life form down there of some sort. Are they creating an energy or a portal to move, beyond dimensions? It sounds like we're creating a big old sci-fi movie right now, but I mean, that theory is as good as any. Or is it just a natural occurring energy spot, which could just pull up bigger storms right in that area, possibly, that is causing some of this? But how do you describe a captain that just goes missing, kind of thing? So, again, that's our rational mind wanting to try to put a rational explanation to it. But, I think sometimes rationality and a good old sci-fi movie can go hand in hand as well.
Brad, if these triangles aren't alien portals, then what do you think they are?
I think we're at a point that science is very arrogant in the reasoning that they can explain away anything, or they've got everything down pat. They know exactly what can and can't happen, and I think that's very far from the truth. I mean, if you look just a century ago where humankind was versus today, the technological advances, if you put out half of what we do, what we use in our everyday lives today, if you would have put that in a book 100 years ago, it would have been considered science fiction. Mm-hmm. It would have said this can never happen. I think there's a lot of natural explanations for everything from hauntings to these possible portals that science just does not understand all of the forms of energy that are out there. Mm-hmm. Or, there's so much that's left to learn yet that I think will develop through the years. And I think 100 years from now, people can look back and listen to this podcast then and say, wow, that's, so-and-so discovered this in 2072 that, this was caused by such and such. It's just science is constantly learning, constantly moving forward. And it really gets irritating, especially in the paranormal field, when people just flat out say, well, no, that can't exist. Well, why not? Well, because it doesn't. There's just no rationale.
Yeah.
And I just think as things develop along, I think a lot of this is just going to become natural activity. Right now, we have no idea. We don't know what's causing this. There are theories that range everywhere from the bizarre down to the mundane of it just being some weather phenomena. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's somewhere in the middle. We don't know.
Very true. Very true. Earlier, we were talking about sea monsters. There was one sea monster in the book that had a natural enemy that could defeat it or knock it back, and that was a thunderbird. Brad, can you explain to me what exactly a thunderbird is? I always thought it was just a Saturday morning cartoon, but I might be wrong.
That was a
big
bird, Tim.
Oh, that was Big Bird. Well, he was kind of scary, too. I mean, let's face it, if you're a timid kid, Big Bird will scare the heck out of you.
And Snuffleupagus.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that too.
The cool thing with the thunderbird and it makes me think there could be something real to this legend, because it's occurred in almost every different culture. The Arabic version is the rock. You've got the thunderbird up here in Native Ojibwe lore, and throughout the U.S., more or less every tribal community had a version of the thunderbird. But this was a giant bird. Nothing prehistoric about it as far as pterodactyl or anything like that. It was just this huge feathered bird, claws that could spear a deer. And in the native legend, some of the sea serpents that would rise up, that was the natural enemy of the thunderbird. The thunderbird could shoot thunder, which it translated more, I believe, into lightning out of its eyes, and it had this huge roar. But it would use these laser beams from the eyes, so to speak, but the lightning blasts to kill these different sea serpents, or at least ward them off. And what one of the more, I guess, specific to the Lake Superior region was the great water cat that protected the copper mines.
Yeah.
And yes, yes, it was, yeah, but they would battle the Thunderbirds, and it would sink anybody that tried to steal the copper from the area up in Western Lake Superior, you know, closer to the western end of the Upper Peninsula. And yeah, there, again, a lot of these great native legends that tied in that, some of the settlers in the area, the voyageurs and the Jesuit missionaries that came over and first explored this area, they started tying a lot of these in to their home country's legends, and some of them to religious legends and lore, and just tried to make this amalgamation to help fit in more with the local tribes. And that's some of the creatures that we see nowadays. It's easy to trace back, some not so much. But I think a lot of these do come from some of these amalgamations of the European settlers and the old Native American lore that's so prevalent in the area.
Wow. Interesting. You know, I guess I'm not well schooled on Thunderbirds, but yeah, reading the book, it was very interesting to delve into that as well. You know, I've always thought of, in switching gears here, I've always thought of Mothman as being an East Coast deal or even a Chicago deal, but I was surprised to read in the book that there have been more Midwest dealings with Mothman. Can you guys fill us in a little bit about some of the dealings with Mothman and some of the places he's been in the Midwest? I was surprised to find out there was Michigan and Wisconsin dealings with Mothman.
I'll defer to Brad on that.
He's like Elvis. They see him everywhere.
Really? Oh.
Yeah, I guess the most prevalent lately has been Chicago.
Yeah.
There have been sightings since, I want to say, around 2017. There have been frequent sightings from, you know, everything from truckers to people walking downtown on their lunch breaks to a lot of blurry photographs. It's kind of like a midair Bigfoot photo, if you will, of what people are claiming to be Mothman. One great sighting down in Indiana, which I believe we touch on a little bit in the book, this farmer was just driving home Christmas Eve, and all of a sudden he slammed on the brakes on his truck, and his wife's, "What in the hell are you doing?" You know, she startled her. She almost went into the dashboard, and he just pointed, and right above the tree line, there was this creature that was, you know, a typical Mothman sighting is not big flapping wings. The wings are outstretched, and it's gliding. And that's exactly what this creature was. He explained it around 8 feet tall. He was guessing from the tree line. He said, you know, I was in the military. I've been a farmer. I'm an outdoorsman. I'm a very rational thinker. He said, I have no idea what this was. So they went home and he told his wife, whatever you do, don't go telling the neighbors about this. We don't want people thinking we're nuts. So naturally, the next day, the wife's together with the neighbors and says, guess what we saw last night? And as it turned out, rather than shun them, a couple of the neighbors said, you know, we've seen the exact same thing. And it's been around the neighborhood at least a couple of weeks now. We've seen it gliding through the trees, and we spotted it out in the woods one night, what we think this was. And it stood about 8 feet tall. They saw glowing eyes. They could just kind of report the outline of the figure. But when they kind of moved closer to it, because they thought it was just a statue, the thing shot straight up. Again, no wing movement, just these outstretched wings that almost look like glider type wings, and it went straight in the air. So that's, again, one of the fascinating things with Mothman. Is this a flesh and blood creature? Could it be some type of alien technology, something in a suit? And it's interesting to think about it, because it doesn't seem to match any type. Like, we can look at Bigfoot and say, okay, that's some type of an ape, you know, something that's left along through the years that hasn't quite evolved all the way. You know, some of these creatures that we see talking about, the sea monsters and Nessie, and are these old dinosaurs that are left behind that haven't quite gone extinct yet. You look at Mothman, and that thing really doesn't sound like anything that exists or has existed that we know about in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what unnerves me about the whole Mothman thing is Mothman tends to be sighted at a place where there's going to be a major disaster or natural disaster just shortly before, you know, shortly after his appearance. And the one that always gets me is, yeah, you know, everybody in the Twin Cities metro area knows where they were the day of the 35W bridge collapse. I myself was working for Minnesota Public Radio at the time, and I had come in to do my shift in it's like an engineering department, and I came in to do my shift, and there on the monitors is the picture of the bridge collapse. Well, you know, about maybe a year or two afterwards, you start to hear the conspiracy theories come up about, you know, someone's got a picture like right underneath the bridge of this weird figure. And I'm guessing you can still Google it. At one time you could Google Mothman 35W bridge collapse and you could get this fuzzy picture of what looks like Mothman underneath the 35W bridge. I don't remember if it was time stamped or not. I don't think it was.
Very similar to the Silver Bridge collapse in West Virginia.
Yeah, yeah. And supposedly Mothman was there, and it was just, I want to say, 6 to 8 hours before the bridge collapse.
Man, what's Mothman got against bridges?
I don't know. That's the thing, right? Why is he taking down bridges across the U.S.? But yeah, I don't get what it is with Mothman and disasters and whether he's bringing these disasters upon these targets or if he's just a warning device, you know.
And it just seems it could be coincidental. These sightings in Chicago now, as I said, they've been going on for years now, but they didn't seem to be these portents of doom that the Silver Bridge, like you said, out there happened. It's this creature that people keep sighting, and they're describing it as very similar to what was spotted with the most famous one, I guess, in West Virginia. That, of course, that wonderful Richard Gere movie was filmed about. So,
yeah, it was a masterpiece.
So I'm looking here, Tim. I did Google what you had said, and yeah, I mean, there's still plenty of links and information out there on the correlation of the I-35W.
Yeah.
Bridge and Mothman. Yeah, there's a ton out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. It's a little scary, you know. If you see Mothman near a bridge, I don't know that I'd drive over it anytime soon. Yeah.
Mothman's not even my favorite though. I like Batsquatch. If you're not familiar with Batsquatch, and a lot of people aren't, I've realized giving talks on this.
Tell us. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Batsquatch is awesome. These guys, the first Midwest report that I could find was, I believe it was back in the late 70s, and these guys were driving home in a truck, and this big creature, they explained it as something with a wingspan that was wider than the front of their pickup, flew by first, they slammed on the brakes, and then it landed in front of them. And the way they described this creature was the body of a German, body and head of roughly a German shepherd looking, almost canine. But they said they guessed that the wingspan was a good 12 feet wide, leathery bat type wings, you know, no feathers. The thing looked at them, screamed, and then took that back off into the air. They guessed it stood probably around 8-9 feet tall.
Whoa.
And they got the hell out of there. They were terrified. I would be too.
Oh, yeah. They
take off and go home. This was just outside of La Crosse, Wisconsin. And suddenly, you know, in the next couple of weeks, there's this rash of pets disappearing. And people are reporting hearing steps on their roofs. And several people came forward and said, there was what I thought was a person up in the trees outside of our house. But it took off and flew off, and this thing was huge. And this lasted for a period of about 2 to 3 weeks in the La Crosse area. And all of a sudden, and this was in the fall time, this was closer to Halloween, which makes it all the creepier.
Absolutely.
Makes for a great story around then. But all of a sudden, the sightings disappeared, which to me almost sounds like it's in a migratory pattern, that it may have just been coming through, hit the area for a little rest, and then back on the way to Florida or wherever Batsquatch winters. So there were a few different cryptid investigations that we have done when we were interviewing people for the book that made it sound like these creatures, things from especially the aerial phenomena that we were uncovering, that they may be migratory creatures, which would explain why you see periods of these. You've got a FAP of these creatures being spotted, be they Thunderbird type creatures, huge birds, or bat squatch, or, you know, Mothman, I guess, is a little more consistent, or it's a one and done sighting on those. But yeah, it almost seems like there could be migration to these animals.
Yeah, never in the same spot for too long.
Mm-hmm. Boy, yeah, I'm looking at pictures of bat squatch online. Just people's interpretation, even the art, doesn't look very very inviting, that's for sure. And I'll have you know there, Mr. Blair, that there is a Bat Squatch IPA.
Yes, there is. We have found that.
I have sampled that.
Have you? How is it?
It's no blats.
It's no blats.
But then again, what is, right?
That's right. True. What is? You're very true on that. Also interested to know that there's been black-eyed kid sightings here, and we'll leave people with this today as far as our monster talk. There's been black-eyed kid sightings here in Minnesota. We're familiar with those. But you've had some out your way in Michigan.
Yeah. Well, one story that is kind of, we did not put in the book due to a little bit more research that happened near the Traverse City area. That we didn't go with because we just could not get enough
validation
to make sure this wasn't just made up. We couldn't get a hold of the person who actually wrote the account.
So one thing we tried to do was separate out the creepypastas in this,
which is hard to do. I mean, yeah. The whole legend and lore field is the whole creepypasta thing. It has changed the how that is all viewed now. I mean, there's some amazing ones that are being created just by creepypasta. So you got to be very careful when you're researching these. And if we could not talk directly to someone who was involved, we just didn't go with it. But yeah, there have been some here in Michigan. And that story, I wish I could find out for sure if it was true, because it is downright creepy.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. The guy was at a campground.
Yeah. It was a very rustic campground. He was an avid biker. He left the family behind for a weekend, just kind of get away and recharge. And he was checking in. He got there late one night and he was checking in. And after he checked in at the office, he went to get start grabbing his gear and start moving into the woods. And he saw these kids that, you know, as so many stories go, they just kind of seem out of place. If I remember correctly, his account, they did ask for, you know, the usual, I can't remember if they needed a ride or the phone, but one of them I know was the question. And that started a 2-day literal horror fest of him trying to get away from these things. Now, he should have left after day one, but he didn't because he figured, you know, he thought maybe the first occurrences that happened that first night were just kind of more of his imagination. He was letting his imagination run wild with him. So he stuck around, went into Traverse City, ate dinner. It was getting late. He was thinking of going home, but it was getting dark. He's like, you know what? I'll stay one more night. And then that's when all hell broke loose for that story.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He kept running into them in odd places. And he was on a rural stretch of beach and looked up, and it was at night, it was late, and there's these two kids. Again, he described them as, at least in the story that we were given, they were wearing the exact same clothes that they were the day before. First time he saw them, the clothes were too baggy, they didn't seem to fit right, and the kids just seemed very out of place.
Yeah.
And they started getting closer to him on the beach, and when they did, he gave them a good look over, and that's when he noticed the eyes. And they were in direct moonlight. And he said just the reflection off the eyes, they were solid black. And they looked and they grinned. And the guy said, I was so uncomfortable. They asked for nothing at the time. They just looked at him. And I've never heard this in a black-eyed kid story, which makes it all the better. They looked at him. He saw the complete blacked out eyeballs. And both kids at the same time flashed a grin at him.
Yeah.
And he turned and took off and ran the hell back to his tent.
Oh. And
locked himself. Wow. As much as you can lock yourself into a tent.
Yeah.
And cowered until the morning.
Yeah. He said he literally probably passed out from fear because he thought one of the last memories he has of that night is he thought he could hear the kids walking around his tent and he was just waiting for them to try to get in. He says, next thing I know, I passed out of some sort and woke up in the morning and he hightailed it out of there. So Sleeping Bear Dunes is the name of the place that this event supposedly took place at. But again, we did not put it in the book as much as we wanted to because we couldn't
get the validation
that we wanted to. Yeah.
Oh,
God, but we do have a black eyed story in there that is every bit as good. And it came firsthand from the woman who experienced it. And as Tim mentioned before, you can be as skeptical as you want. And we're very skeptical when we go into researching this. But to this lady, it happened the way that she said it happened, and her life changed after that.
Yeah, and one thing I talk about at our presentations too is this was the one that the Black Eyed Kids is one of the chapters that I wrote, and it kept me up at night while I was writing it. It took me a couple nights to get it down the way I wanted to, and I would sit there and write, and I would go to bed at night, and I had trouble falling asleep for a few nights finishing up that chapter because of the account that happened to this lady.
Wow. All right.
You'll have to buy the book to read that.
Yeah. You definitely got to get the book. I mean, regardless, you got to get the book. There's lots of great stuff in this book. Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries is the name of the book. We're not letting you guys go yet because we got one more thing to talk about, but that's the name of the book, Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries. It's available at upernaturalhaunts.com. We'll have the link in the description of this program. Guys, before we let you go today, we got to talk Michigan Paracon this year. Again, SaultMarie.com. That's SaultMarie.com. I got it right, Brad?
A mouthful there, but you nailed it.
You can also hit miparacon.com, and that's going to link you to it.
Yeah, MI as in Michigan, paracon.com, and that'll get you right there, too.
Okay, you could have told me that, too.
Yeah, I know. We wanted to hear you spell it out.
Well, I got it. I stuck the landing on that deal. Okay, so miparacon.com. First of all, I got to ask you, year after year after year, you guys hit home runs on this deal. You bring in the heavy hitters every single year. You guys do have, I think you can toot your own horn here. And if you can do it, by gosh, you know, yoga, but you can toot your own horn here. And you got to say you're the number one Paracon in the nation. You guys managed to get the heavy hitters, anybody who's anybody in the paranormal field into your convention. How do you guys do it from year after year after year? I don't think you're missing anybody on this deal.
A lot of beer.
Yeah, we drink a lot. Then we sit down and put it together. it's one of those things that, you know, it wasn't always that way. And when we formed the event back 10, 11, 12, 13 years ago now, it was one of those things that we said we have to put out a good enough, strong enough product that people are going to want, that they're going to travel to Michigan's Upper Peninsula here, as some people describe as the middle of nowhere, that would draw the crowds here. And the first year we did, two or three presentations on a Friday, and then we had half a dozen on a Saturday. And now, we start Thursday afternoon, we do something for a pregame on Wednesday night, and all day Friday, all day Saturday, plus psychic galleries, workshops with some of your favorite celebrities and experts in the field, if there is such a thing. It's built, and it just kind of got to the point, I guess, that we, I don't know how to say it right without, we got to the point that people wanted to do our show. I think they recognized the work we put into it, and they knew that they weren't going to get hornswoggled.
Yeah. Yeah. Reputation's everything. And we worked our tails off to make sure we work hard. We literally work all year on this. And when the weekend gets here, it's all hands on deck, and us and our entire team put it all on the floor for that weekend, because we want it to be an amazing experience, not only for those who are buying the tickets to be there, but for you guys who we bring in, Tim. And we want you guys to have an amazing time too, because that is where the reputation is built. It's a small, the paranormal field is a very small community. It really is. And you guys all talk to each other. We all talk to each other. And it over the years, we've watched our event get shared through conversations. And as Brad had said, there came a shift where it got to the point where the reputation was there, and the amazing stories that our presenters have shared with others, that now we've got people contacting us to be a part of it as well. And that's all due to the hard work to get to this point.
Well, I'll tell you, your team does an amazing job. I haven't seen a team that works as hard at any convention, and I'm talking, I've done not just I missed that punchline, whatever it was. I'm sorry.
I said or drinks as much. You said it work as hard, and I said or drink as much.
That's true.
They can play hard.
Yes, we do. We work and play hard. You got it.
Well, they're an amazing team. They deserve it. I'll tell you, and I'm not just talking in the paranormal convention field. I'm talking any convention field. I mean, they really knock it out of the park every single year. And I'll tell you, I don't know that I represent the entire paranormal speaker field, but I can tell you that each and every one of us is taken care of as we walk through the door. And we thank you guys for that, because you guys are amazing. And I'll tell you, as someone who attends the convention, you're going to get taken care of. You guys are in for an amazing weekend. You got to get out there this weekend, or that it takes place, folks. It's Thursday, August 25th through Saturday, August 27th this year. And boy, I'll tell you, folks, anybody who's anybody is at this thing. Chip Coffey, Jason Haas, just to name a few, Amy Bruni, Steve Gonzalez, Dakota Layden, Chelsea Layden. You got the kids from Destination Fear out there this year, which is really cool.
That was one of our biggest requests this year, was for these kids. And Tim and I have never met them yet.
No, this will be our first time meeting them, and looking forward to it as well.
We had so many fan requests, though, that we went out and got in touch with them. And they said, yeah, they don't like to do a lot of these events, but they'd heard good things about ours and were willing to come. And I guess a couple people in the field stuck their necks out and told them that they would enjoy it, have a good time. And you know, we're a little more no-nonsense when it comes to the business end of things, mm-hmm. but we make sure, as Tim said, everybody from the presenters to the attendees to our volunteers, which we can't thank enough, the great people that come out and help us out, we make sure they're all taken care of, and it's just worked.
Yeah,
it has. And for the first time ever, just to kind of, you know, put an exclamation mark on how this event just continues to grow, for the first time ever, 4 full vendor rooms too. So
yeah. Wow. Yeah,
we've got a waiting list for vendor space, and we were able to secure another room. So we've got 4 full vendor rooms this year.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I was going to say, I've had Dakota and Tanner here on the show, and they're amazing. So I think you guys are going to love them. They're the Destination Fear kids are really, really cool. And just anybody who's anybody. You got the Ghost Brothers guys out there this year again, too. Those guys are amazing. Just anybody who's on television, or anybody you've heard here on the show.
I'm looking forward to actually sitting down and listening to, and you know, behind the scenes, we're running nonstop. We don't get to actually enjoy the presentations that the attendees do, but for the first time ever, we've gotten Dacre Stoker coming.
Yes.
Name might not ring a lot of bells, but you've probably heard of his great uncle, Bram Stoker, mm-hmm. who wrote a little book called Dracula. And this is the 125th anniversary of the publishing of Dracula this mm-hmm. year. And Dacre is an author in his own right. He's taken the Dracula legend and wrote a couple prequels that are very good. And he runs the Bram Stoker Estate. And we reached out to him just before COVID, and we'd had him in agreement to come in and give a talk and sign some books and do some meet and greets. And of course, the world went to hell there for a couple of years. And he's finally making it up here this year. So that is the one. If I can sit down and listen to one presentation, I've always been fascinated with the Dracula storyline and how it came about. And he has Bram's old notes. He has some of Bram's old books in his possession. So he's really sat, talked to family members, talked to friends that have heard these legends, these stories passed down on how Dracula came to be and the whole legacy of Dracula. So we gave him a little bit more time. He's going to be speaking for about an hour and a half on Friday night. That's the one that I'm looking forward to this year. That on wood, if I can get away from backstage and our tables and everything else, that's the one that I want to sit in on.
That is awesome. We had Dacre on the show a couple weeks ago. We talked about him being at Michigan Paracon as well, and he's got some exclusive stuff he's going to have at his table for Michigan Paracon as well. So And I can tell you this much, he's really looking forward to Michigan Paracon as well. So
excellent.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's going to be awesome as well. So yeah, folks, there's still weekend passes available for Michigan Paracon. Again, miparacon.com. Myself and Tim Weisberg are speaking Friday morning. So come on out and listen to us talk about some of our more unusual experiences we've had in paranormal media. That's at 10:05 a.m. on Friday morning. Guys, again, upernaturalhaunts.com. We'll have the link in the description of the show to get the new book. Actually, the book has been out for a little bit, hasn't it?
Last year.
Yep.
Last year. Oh, well, that's new. Great Lakes Monsters and Mysteries. It's on the Visionary Living imprint. So, Brad Ellis, listen, you're not married to Tim.
I think there's a few people out there who would say we're together enough.
Much to Lindsay's chagrin, you're not married to Tim. Brad Blair, Tim Ellis, thank you so much for being with us here on Darkness Radio today.
Thanks, Tim. Awesome. Thanks for having us, Tim.
Thank you. And folks, I want to thank you so much for joining us here this week. I want to thank our sponsors for sponsoring the show as well. I want to remind you folks to visit our sponsors and continue supporting our sponsors. They're who help us bring you this program. So please continue visiting our sponsors and supporting our sponsors and help this program continue on. Also, folks, I want to remind you, it's a little bit darker time out there in the world. I want you to continue putting a little bit of light into the darkness. I want you to take care of yourself and each other. Go out there and do something nice for somebody this weekend. If you see somebody in need, go ahead, give them a helping hand. It takes just a little bit of time. Maybe it's even a few dollars. Somebody who needs something, go out there and help them this weekend. It'll put a little bit of light into the world. And if each and every one of us does that, we can make the world a little bit better place this weekend. For Beer City Bruiser, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for joining us this week. For the best in paranormal podcasting, this has been Darkness Radio.